Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
So I'm going to introduce you a little bit to our Stem Cell Institute. You're probably aware of this, but you know it's the darling of Dr. Jameson. She's our director. And we are the only fully integrated regenerative medicine institute in the U.S. You know, through our, of course, generous philanthropy from Denny Sanford and grants that we have through CIRM and the support of the university, we have really something special here in San Diego. And one of the things that we do is this global hub for stem cell science in space. It's something that Dr. Jameson does and Dr. Motri, and you're going to hear more about some of those things today. We have six centers. I run one of those, which is the clinical center, and you're going to hear about these other ones. We also have our director here for one of our centers as well that is going to give us a talk, and one of our deputy directors as well. And so, yeah, we really cross a lot of disciplines because stem cell regenerative medicine isn't just one organ system. It's about regenerating all organ systems. It's about, you know, bringing back treating cancers. It's about, you know, regenerating tissues. It's about protecting tissues. So we're pretty open-minded about what we're going to do. And ultimately, my favorite part, of course, is they're doing clinical trials. That's what I do. And running their clinical trial team and trying to bring that to bed. So we now are also doing some standard of care therapy in our cellular medicine program. We've instituted TIL therapy, one of the only one in San Diego really right now doing that. So, you know, ideally we'll be adopting these treatments in the future and bringing them to everyone in their primary care. Here's our director, Dr. Jameson. She's well known to many of you, as she's been instrumental in developing new clinical treatments, and also, you know, in developing even in the new drug that she's working on now, Rebexinib, which has funding through both CIRM and NASA for development. So she's got multiple patents. She's done seven missions to the International Space Station, and so really looking for new solutions in new worlds. Here she is. This is my, she's there with one of our other leaders, Alex Kalesi and Chris Longhurst, who's head of innovation at the university. Dr. Alex Kalesi is head of our, co-leads our brain program, and is one of our, you know, neurosurgeons, and of course the leader of the Neurosurgical Society in the U.S. right now. This is them standing in front of one of the starships that was being pushed into place yesterday. And then here's some footage from Dr. Jameson from just an hour ago. I don't know if you know about how the Starship works, but it's a huge rocket, like twice the size of anything else. It can carry 1,000 kilograms. And you've heard of SpaceX, how it comes back. Well, this is the launch, you know, part of the rocket coming back. And if you haven't seen this before, where it gets caught in the arms of the actual launch site. All right. So that was earlier today, that a couple hours ago. So she's on her way back. So I wish I was there, but here I've got to be here doing this for you. So we have introducing our team here. We have, you know, like I said, many 12 directors and deputy directors. We have many publications, many citations that come out of our team. Really a top-notch group of scientists and investigators that we have. We have the six centers I refer to and a brain tumor program. So really, you know, seven major endeavors here. Discovery Center, Advanced Therapy Center, where they make the cells. Discovery Center, where they're more basic science. Innovation Center is really trying to translational piece, trying to make, you know, new products into and alliances with companies. I run this clinical center. We run clinical trials. I think we support about 38 different clinical trials right now in stem cells, regenerative medicine. And then there's the iScore. There's two programs here. The iScore program is really what we're talking about there, the missions to space, and particularly focusing on stem cells in space and how that can be used to solve problems down here, because we see that as a way to test cancer and early sort of pre-cancer type changes that happen more rapidly in space. And then speaking today, our Space Medicine Center with Dr. Kesaliva, she's going to speak to us, and Ludmila as well. And I'll talk a little bit. They're going to introduce more of those today. So with that, I think I can move on to our next and first speaker, who you also may be very familiar with. It's Dr. David Brenner. He's the president and CEO of Sense and Burnham Prebys, and longtime vice chancellor of health sciences for the UC San Diego. And you may know him well from his leadership position, but he's also quite a famous scientist, and in particular in studying liver. And a more recent thing is really their endeavors in looking at longevity. And that really has important implications with stem cells as well. And so currently there's some very interesting work that they're doing. And they get to travel all over the world and to Italy for this, which is a bonus. So David, why don't you come up? And we're going to get your slides, you know, on the reel here so you can go. Hopefully I didn't take too long.
No, thank you. I hope everyone recognizes these three distinguished gentlemen. I know them because they're on the door as I come into work every day. Sanford Burnham and Prebys. And so I'm just going to, like, light introduction. And Tatiana, who's the center director, and Ludmila, who's the deputy director, they're going to do the heavy lifting, right? So I don't have to do that much. It's a really good deal for me. Okay, so we got this title of stem cells, but stem cells in the liver are somewhat controversial. So I just want to put this in a slightly bigger context of aging. One of the aspects of aging is stem cells, but there are also other aspects like your telomeres shorten or your DNA gets changed or you have chronic inflammation or you have mutations. So in the liver, we have trouble distinguishing those. So I'm just going to group those all together into the idea of aging. And if I get it wrong, Ludmila will correct me because he is the world's expert. Okay, so how are these related? And that is Sheldon on the rocket. So how, we have three topics, and how are they related? I'm just gonna try to get you oriented, and then they'll do the actual experiments. So we have healthy aging, we have space, and we have the liver, okay? There is incredible good data that healthy aging and a healthy liver are related. That you know, if you maintain your liver in good shape, that you will age well, and if you don't, you won't. So and I'm gonna just tell you a little bit about that because I think it's really fascinating. And in fact, the liver itself is not usually the cause that gets you in trouble. The liver actually gets you in trouble for because you get other diseases. Okay. However, this is Sheldon again. This is in space, for reasons we don't understand, your liver gets sick. And Tatiana's going to tell you about that. It gets fat in the liver, it gets inflamed, it gets what looks like classic liver disease. So, okay, so healthy liver's good, space flight's bad. The other thing I learned is that the astronauts also have accelerated aging. Many things that are considered classic aging, like your bones getting less dense, your muscles getting weaker, happen at an accelerated rate. Your telomeres get shorter when you're in space, okay? So that's how they're related. And will a healthy liver prevent this? I don't know. Ludmila's nodding his head yes, so maybe it's right. Okay, so the take-home message is love your liver, all right? And that's pretty much all I want you to remember from my talk. However, not everyone believes that. Some people believe I'd rather be a good liver than have one. And so what Tatiana is going to tell you is there's some, even if you're not that well behaved, there's some things you can do that will make your liver work better. Okay, this is your liver, right upper quadrant, gallbladder, stomach. In most of us who do not have viral illnesses or other things, most of us as Americans are at risk of what's called a metabolic syndrome, which is a group of diseases that's associated with increased risk of heart disease, increased risk of stroke, increased risk of diabetes, and it's mostly associated with obesity. And with obesity, there's high blood pressure, high serum glucose, high serum triglycerol, and reduction in the good cholesterol, HDL cholesterol. So even though I am a hepatologist, I study liver disease, I have to acknowledge that this metabolic syndrome affects to a large extent the heart, the kidneys, as well as your pancreas for diabetes. So even though the liver gets inflamed and damaged, it's the heart that really gets you in trouble. And that the liver disease is called MASLD, which stands for Metabolic Dysfunction Associated Steatotic Liver Disease. It used to be called NASH, but they decided that the alcohol in NASH was derogatory, so they dropped it. So now you get this terrible thing, MASLD, that can go all the ways from, I didn't vote for that. I was one of the one people, the one hepatologist voted against changing the name. From a normal liver, to a fatty liver, to inflamed liver, to a scarred liver. Okay. And when you have that happen, all of the functions of the liver are affected. And I think that's the take-home message. When the liver is not functioning well, it affects your entire body, because the liver is responsible for clearing toxins. The liver is responsible for making products like albumin and clotting factors. The liver is responsible for clearing bacteria from your blood. So for all these reasons, if the liver is not functioning, the rest of the body suffers. And in particular, we have noticed, and many other people have noticed, there seems a relationship between obesity and the fatty liver, and aging and the fatty liver. So the two things are related. So if you can keep a healthy liver, it seems to slow down aging, maybe. If you have both obesity and this metabolic syndrome, with age, it accelerates. But again, it's not so much the liver that gets you in trouble, but the cardiovascular disease. So a healthy liver is associated with healthy aging and with a good cardiovascular function, and the damaged liver is associated with the opposite. Okay. This is just the one piece of data I'm going to show that shows the worse your liver disease, the higher your risk of dying, including of dying of cardiovascular disease. Okay? That's the one piece of data that I won't torture you anymore. So there are places throughout the world, there's some which are called blue zones, where people live on average 10 years longer, and they live healthily 10 years longer in the surrounding communities. And because we're interested in this, Tatiana and I get invited, and Sheldon was alluding to this, so to all and they actually are always in nice places. They're Okinawa, Italy, Greece, Costa Rica. It's not bad, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, so these people are very descriptive investigators, no hard data. And what they have said, and this is, so I think this is right, the four things associated with healthy aging, according to Okinawa Way, it's good diet, exercise, self-compassion, and community. And I'm happy after the talk, when we're done, to tell you more about it. So we decided to study one area in southern Italy. This is my colleague and friend, Salvatore Di Somma, who is professor at University of Rome, and to look at real science, intensely studying a group of patients, 150 people over 100 years old, and matching controls, and do what we do in San Diego, which is not descriptive. It is looking at all the different areas of genetics, the transcriptome, the change in mRNA, the change in DNA, the change in metabolites, and try to understand what's different between people who have successful healthy aging and those who don't. So this is really the first study to do this, and I wrote this up a little bit in the San Diego Union Tribune a couple months ago. They gave me a column, so if you're interested, you can follow me. And then we went to visit this centenarian. I'm just gonna show you just 2 minutes of our discussion with this 101-year-old woman from southern Italy.
The region of Cilento lies on the western coast of Italy, south of Naples. It includes a sprawling national park of forested mountains and rugged coastline overlooking the Mediterranean Sea. Ernest Hemingway liked to stay here when he visited Italy after World War II. But the place has an older claim to fame. Its residents tend to live a very long time. Since 2016, researchers at Sanford Burnham Prebys, the Sanford Stem Cell Institute of UC San Diego, and the University of Rome, La Sapienza, have been studying the centenarians of Cilento, who not only live unusually long lives, but do so robustly, with very low rates of heart disease and dementia. These scientists want to learn how their lifestyle and health behaviors might impact longevity. In particular, the role of the Mediterranean diet, which was first described in Cilento. Recently, David Brenner, one of the study's co-principal investigators, sat down with one of the study's participants, a 101-year-old woman named Nicolina. He was accompanied by lead Italian investigator Salvatore Di Somma, UC San Diego professor Tatiana Kisileva, and Maria Antonia Marino, Nicolina's family physician.
Ma no, la faccia a me non era una cosa, faceva serena, un dolcetto, una cosa.
No.
E me non era niente.
No, non ci dai abbastanza quello che dite.
She's so sorry that she was not able to prepare something special for you. She's really sorry.
È tutto normale.
È normale, ma io faccio una brutta figura.
She says that what a reputation they have on me if I'm not preparing something for them. Maria Antonia, lei non ha malattie importanti.
No, ringraziamo a Dio.
She's già piglia solo un poco di pressione, figlia la pressione.
No, è perché questa si ingazza facilmente. Deve attaccare a banda col figlio, con i nipoti, deve fare tutto bene in ospedale.
She never had any kind of surgeon. She has never been in the hospital.
Solo io.
Look.
She's
No, just a small amount of ACE inhibitor. Very small amount.
No, ogni tanto. Perché lei
not every day.
But it's online. If anyone wants it, arrest me and I'll send it to you. But she goes on, and for the first half hour, she's convinced Tatiana spoke Italian. Then she looks at her and said, "You don't speak Italian, do you?" And Tatiana said, "No." So I'm going to stop here and turn it over to people going to give you some more information. Thank you.
So the way it's going to work is we're going to get the speakers, and then we're going to have some time for talk. We'll bring up the speakers, and you can ask questions. But for now, I think we're going to move on to Dr. Kisileva, who's our director. She's an associate professor of surgery at UC San Diego School of Medicine, and she's the endowed chair at the Sanford Stem Cell Institute as the director of the Sanford Stem Cell Fitness and Space Medicine Center. And also, so she's had a history of being a liver surgeon and obviously is a very well-known researcher in her own right. And she's going to talk to us more about the MASH and space. So come on up. No, thank you.
Thank you. So one lesson I have heard, I have learned from Nicolina, one glass of wine a day is good for you. So I want to sort of like link aging, space medicine, and liver disease. And so we would like to discuss how to implement healthy aging in the era of obesity, which is a big problem, especially in the United States. And are there any lessons that we can learn from space medicine? Because all the processes, David said, are accelerated in space. And what are potential treatments? So what astronauts have in common with obese or aged individuals? And this is liver injury. And obesity accelerates unhealthy aging and liver injury. And why do astronauts develop liver injury in space? So I would like to demonstrate you the histology of the liver. And this is a very severe case. So, but nevertheless, so liver responds to different kind of insult, especially metabolic injury, with specific changes. And the first specific change is the accumulation of fat in the liver. And this round white structures is the deposition of fat. But by itself, it's sort of considered to be a benign condition. It doesn't really cause injury. However, what happens next, if insult continues and liver injury continues, there is development of inflammation. And as you see, this is tiny little blue nuclei reflect the influx of inflammatory cells in the liver. And that potentially causes to activation of cells, myofibroblasts, which make liver fibrotic. So the liver tries to seal the injury. And what you see on the right, this is this red scar,
because it sort of like tries to stop inflammation and injury, and it totally seals this part of liver, and the liver is not functional anymore. So that's what the histology is. And again, the histology looks very similar in metabolic disease, which David said it was called MASH or muscle, aged liver, and space flight injured liver. And it's really remarkable because astronauts are the healthiest people in the world. How do they get this injury? And this is what we're going to try to understand. And unfortunately, the space flights are complicated for the body because there is no gravity and there is a very strong radiation. And what does it cause? First of all, is deterioration of the bone and the muscle. So the redistribution of calcium, it goes to the arms and it's totally washed out of the lower extremities. Abnormal generation of immature progenitors and immune hematological systems. So the normally stem cells stay in the bone marrow, but in space they actually egress from the bone marrow where they're not supposed to go. So the second is redistribution of body fluid, including blood. Changes in the cardiovascular function, changes in neurovestibular system, and finally, it's metabolic liver injury. So astronauts may develop liver disease during space flights, which also associated with diabetes. Space flight can induce insulin resistance in astronauts. Liver metabolism, they develop fatty liver. Liver accumulation, inflammation, and finally, they also activate myofibroblasts, which make liver fibrotic. And there were a couple of experiments with rodents, with mice. 2 weeks in space, and mice develop liver fibrosis, which is remarkable. So I think that astronauts are more resilient to this, but at least, you know, there is science behind this that it's really a problem. And the effect of space flight on human livers has not been really elucidated to the important level. So what are the causes of this liver injury? And it's very difficult to say what is the chicken or the egg, but the stress of the body, this lifestyle, actually initiates this injury. And the damage to the DNA is really important. So with other words, you know, cells replicate, but they can make mistakes. And normally the system eliminates these mistakes. But when the organism is exhausted with metabolic syndrome or aging, so mistakes accumulate. And that causes, again, telomere shortening. Very important part is this changes, which are not on mutation level, mutation or genetic level, but on epigenetic level, like the opening of chromatin. And this transcription actually accelerates transcription of genes, which were not supposed to be transcribed. But one of the important part of this is the cell understands that it's already damaged and it shuts down. And the process which the cell undergo is called senescence. It's a sort of like hibernation. The cell doesn't die, but it also doesn't live. So what happens with these senescent cells? They are very damaging for the body. And if you see it here, so they secrete enormous amount of factors which are damaging for the neighboring cells. So senescent cells, they escape death. So they figure out how to not to be recognized by immune system and persist in the body. So they secrete inflammatory cytokines and make liver even more damaged than it is. So then induce senescence by neighboring cells. They sort of like try to convert them into the same state as they are. They also can give rise to cancer cells. And finally, they can also migrate and like metastasize similar as cancer cells and also corrupt cells in the different organs and systems. So liver function in the space medicine. And we wanted to address this question by analysis of liver with metabolic syndrome. And we performed this study in our laboratory where we analyzed normal, muscle, and MASH livers. So muscle is just steatosis, and MASH is the very strong inflammation, steatosis, and fibrosis. And we looked for the gene expression profile and also the areas of open chromatin. So how this gene expression is regulated. And so we identified different cell types, but we focused our study on hepatocytes, so the cells which become first steatotic and then dysfunctional. So here we look, this is the all population of hepatocytes which identify with the computational analysis, and we see that green hepatocytes are normal, but diseased MASH hepatocytes, they provide really one specific population. And interestingly enough, that this specific population is very highly enriched in senescent cells, which do not die, but they also corrupt other cells. And this is similar histology that I showed you before. So again, we can identify by spatial transcriptomics, we can actually look for the gene expression profile on the tissues, and we can identify all kind of cells in the liver. So here we focus just on senescent cells. And we can identify senescent score and look where they're located. So senescent cells are here shown in red. In blue, this is the fibrous scar. And the areas of normal liver are totally sealed and they are very damaged. So senescent cells are located between fibrous scar and they corrupt the liver function. So what we have done, we generated livers in the dish. So we have a collaborative with Life Sharing Organ Procurement Organization. So we receive all the livers that are not transplanted. So we have now a collection of 200 livers and we can actually identify and characterize every donor. So we isolate the cells and here's hepatocytes. And if we make them senescent by overexpression of P21, they upregulate all chemokines and all bad factors that make them really bad for the liver. So here we generate the liver by combining all the liver cells. And so we have a liver spheroid. And if we induce metabolic syndrome in this three-dimensional liver in the dish, look what happens. So this is the normal spheroid, normal liver, and this is the MASH liver. It upregulates lipids in response to injury. But if the cells are senescent, they do not function. They do not upregulate lipids. So that means the senescent cells cannot function as normal hepatocytes. So how can we treat it? So the solution is the senolytics. Senolytics are bioactive compounds that specifically target and induce death in senescent cells. And targeted removal of these senescent cells through senolytics was shown to enhance lifespan, systemic inflammation, improve organ functions, and several senolytics already have been in clinical trials. So what we have done here, so we have this senescent spheroids, three-dimensional liver in the dish, and then we induce liver injury and then add senolytic. And we see that all parameters are very much improved. So this is a very strong indication that senolytics can prevent liver injury. In addition, so potential treatments, prevention of obesity and insulin resistant, and GLP-1 agonists are potentially can be a solution for people who have problems with the weight, targeting senescent cells with senolytics. And finally, there is a new, very experimental treatment, rejuvenation of stem cells with pluripotent reprogramming using Yamanaka factors. So I hope I convinced you that liver is really important for you. And astronauts really have to think about it. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much, Tatiana. Okay, so our next speaker is Ludmil Alexandrov. He's a professor in the Department of Cellular and Molecular Medicine here and is our deputy director here at the Sanford Stem Cell Fitness and Space Medicine Center. And if you don't know Dr. Alexandrov, he's like one of our star researchers at the university. Like really, like this guy really brings out the papers. He works on the omics and finding mutational patterns for precancer and cancer. So so he smart guy here. So he's going to give us his presentation. Somatic mutation, no pressure.
Thank you so much, Sheldon, for that introduction. So my name is Ludmil. I work on mutations. I care of how DNA changes in your body, in our bodies. And specifically here, I'm going to tell you what mutations are, what are the mutational processes that are in liver, and why we should care what's the relevance when it comes to regenerative and space medicine. I put my faculty disclosures because I'm required to do it. So what are somatic mutations and why do they matter? And I think a lot of people, when you tell them mutations, they have some idea what a mutation is. And most of the time, that's the wrong idea. So let me just give you key facts. Our body has between 30 and 40 trillion cells. I'm a big guy, probably more than 40 trillion. If you have a smaller person, probably less than 30 trillion. But you have trillions of cells in your body. Each one of these cells typically is going to have 23 chromosomes, two pairs of those, so 46 in total. And again, these 46 chromosomes are going to have 6.4, 6.5 billion DNA base pairs. So you have 40, 50 trillion cells, each one of them having 6.5 billion DNA base pairs. There is a lot of DNA in our body. A mutation is a change of one of those base pairs. And again, people, when you think about DNA, I mean, immediately you have the connection with the double helix, and maybe you know that there is specific letters or specific base pairs and specific pairings. And again, change, when we talk about mutations, we're talking about changing of the genetic code. Now, the reason I said that people have misconception about mutations is they're going to see this image and they're going to say, that's a mutation, and that's not a mutation. And, you know, it's very pretty, and what it shows you is that part of DNA is broken. The DNA is damaged, but that doesn't mean the DNA is mutated. As a matter of fact, DNA can be damaged in many, many different ways. I showed you a single-strand break. You can have the bases being weirdly linked with cross-links. You can have missing bases. You can have some adducts. You can have the whole double helix being broken. All of those things happen all the time. As a matter of fact, our body, every cell in our body is going to accumulate between 10,000 and 100,000 DNA damage events per day. So most of the outlier will be your skin cells. They're exposed to ultraviolet light. You're talking about hundreds of thousands. The most protected cells are going to be the ones that you reproduce for. With the sperm accumulates very few DNA damage events. The eggs in the women accumulate very few DNA damage events. So there is quite the variability. Having said that, that's per day. In a year, most of the cells are going to accumulate between 1 and 70 somatic mutations. So we are talking about repair processes that have an efficiency of 99.9999%. They're extremely efficient. They repair this damage. And sometimes a mutation is you misrepair the damage. You actually, instead of repairing it correctly, you change that base. And you get to this thing. You change the genetic code. Now, as I said, you have 6.4 billion of those base pairs in every single cell. Changing one of those doesn't seem to be a big deal. But imagine now that you're changing one of those a year in every single one of those cells. Just by chance, they can hit the right genes. These right genes could result, let's say, to clonal expansions. They could lead to cancer. Or they could lead to the cell not being able to function properly. An example that we all have is, if you look on your skin, you have a mole. And what a mole is, it's a melanocyte, which has a BRAF mutation that has made it expanded. And you can actually see that. And you can see that from a very, very early age. So these things have a functional effect. And again, they can actually cause quite a lot of diseases. Now, how do they accumulate? Where do mutations come from? Well, they start accumulating since the very first division of the fertilized egg each one of us came from. When that egg starts dividing, we start accumulating mutations. Now, it's a slow accumulation, but we still accumulate them. In the world of cancer, and I live mostly in the world of cancer most of the time, when we talk about mutations, we think about passengers. We call them passengers because they're kind of all around. They don't do anything. And there is drivers. And these are the drivers are the ones that would drive the cancer, that would drive the expansion that you can try to actually intervene. So as we progress through our developmental program, we start living in specific environment. We start making specific lifestyle choices. For example, if you make the lifestyle choice to smoke tobacco cigarettes, you're going to be mutating at a very high rate 12 organs in your body. One of them is the lungs, but another one is the liver. And these mutations are going to accumulate. Not only that, depending on how you smoke cigarettes, what type of cigarettes you smoke, that mutation rate is going to be different. Now, the majority of those mutations will be passengers. They would not affect cellular phenotype. They will not have any effect on cells. But again, just by chance, you get hit a gene like BRAF, you get that mole, that little growth that doesn't mean anything. It may even expand to a little polyp, again, not particularly relevant. You know, it doesn't impair the function of the organ. That cell may or may not acquire a mutator phenotype, so it mutates faster. But eventually, you may get an invasive cancer, an early invasive cancer. And just for reference, one of every two people will get a cancer in their lifetime. One of every three is going to die from cancer. So it's something that happens quite often. And that's going to progress to late cancer. And again, you can try to treat that cancer if you do it with chemotherapy drugs. What do they do most of the time, traditional chemotherapy? Well, they damage DNA. And they're going to actually create resistance by damaging DNA. So what you see in this half circle is how mutations are accumulating throughout life. They start from the first time, from conception, and they continue through your whole life. But we do not accumulate mutations at the same rate because we have A, different genetics, but more importantly, different lifestyles, different environments. So what does that mean for the liver? How do we accumulate mutations in the liver? And I have to say, the liver is quite a remarkable organ. Actually, David introduced me to the liver first. He described it to me. And you can, when you start looking at the metabolic activities and the things that it can do, there is nothing like it. So let's see what causes mutations in the liver. You have healthy liver, you have fatty liver, you have fibrotic, you have cirrhotic, you have liver cancer. You have environmental exposures. You can have things, whether they're molds, things that are happening that can actually directly damage the liver. Infections, again, you have your hepatitis viruses that can cause, can change DNA and can affect liver. Lifestyle choices, smoking cigarettes, drinking alcohol excessively, being overweight or obese. Metabolic conditions, again, just because you have a condition of the liver, it starts accumulating, as Tatiana was saying, it starts being dysfunctional, it starts accumulating mutations faster. And you also have just life, mutations accumulating with life that just because they exist, just because cells divide, just because they need to produce energy. So these are the causes of mutations, but how many mutations would you accumulate? So how many mutations would a healthy individual accumulate? So we expect a 50-year-old, I took a 50-year-old as a reference, to accumulate about between 25 and 30 mutations per year. What does it mean to be a healthy person? Well, you're not obese or overweight. You don't drink excessively. You don't smoke cigarettes, tobacco products. Essentially, you have what we'll consider a healthy lifestyle. So each one of the 300 billion liver cells that we have in our body is going to have about 1,500 mutations in a healthy individual. Now, let's look at somebody who has a metabolic dysfunction for one reason or another. When we look at those individuals at around the age of 50, they're going to have between 2,000 and 5,000 mutations. So now you're moving to significantly more mutations, greater chance to hit these genes and get some kind of disease, some kind of even cancer. Let's look at cirrhotic liver. Now you're going even a level up. You know, somebody who is consuming, let's say, a lot of alcohol, you can have a 50-year-old is going to have between 2,500 and 7,500 mutations, again, in every single cell of that liver. So these mutations accumulate. Just because they're accumulating, some of those cells will become senescent, some of them are going to die, some of them are not going to be functioning properly. And let's look at liver cancer. A 50-year-old, if we look at the cancers of liver cancers in 50-year-olds, on average, they'll have 15,000 mutations, and we'll have very few people that are going to have very small number, below 6,000 mutations. So you have a lot of dysfunction. You have things that have made that cancer divide. And you can say, well, what causes those mutations, right? We talked about different things. Me and my team, we have studied extensively the different mutagenic processes in the liver. Again, the liver has probably the most diverse set of mutagenic processes. We have, at the moment, 34 that are very well mapped and described. And some of those are the trivial one, alcohol and tobacco smoking. You know that they're there, we can detect them, we can describe them. But some of them are quite unusual, aflatoxin. Now, what you see here is mold growing on corn. That mold is highly mutagenic and highly carcinogenic in places that there is no refrigeration. Think rural India, Southeast Asia, they consume it. they have an epidemic of liver cancer. In the United States and Western Europe, we can look at the liver cancers. About 3 to 4% of all liver cancers are caused by that. And again, you may or may not see, there will be recalls of carrots with aflatoxin or just moldy vegetables. So it does happen, but at much, much lower rates. Another thing that's unusual, and there's quite a few of those, but I just want to show you these two examples, are aristolochic acid. So this beautiful plant, and you see the real plant and a drawing of the plant, is actually very, very popular in China and in Taiwan. And it's part of Chinese traditional medicine. It's used for a number of pain relief. It's also used for fever. It's commonly included. The problem with this medicine, it's highly mutagenic. And when you actually consume it, it's going to cause a lot of liver damage and it's going to cause a lot of mutations. And again, you're going to see those liver cancer incidence rates being highest in China, and again, very high levels in Taiwan, because this is being used at very high levels. And again, we can go through many different things that cause this in the liver, and there is quite a lot of remarkable things happening in different parts of the world. So this was the liver, these were the mutations, but this is all on Earth. So what's the relevance when it comes to regenerative and space medicine? Okay, so what do we know about somatic mutations in space? Well, we didn't know much until recently, until Kat Jamieson initiated this institute and we kind of started looking at things. So the thing that we have studied most extensively is hematopoietic stem cells. These are the stem cells that give rise to blood. And the reason we can study them easily is one, you can sample them easily from individuals. You can actually grow them in nanobioreactors in the International Space Station. And what we know on the ground is these stem cells will acquire 5 times less mutations, so they're protected than if you look at other blood cells. So they acquire much, much less mutations. When you put them in space and you put them for 20 days in space, the number of mutations they're going to accumulate is equivalent to 6 months of being on the ground. So you're getting this accumulation of mutations. And again, these are stem cells. These are probably one of the most protected, other than, let's say, the sperm and the eggs, most protected cells of the body. You're seeing an amplification of 6 times, 7 times. What would happen to something like the liver, where you're going to be consuming food, you're going to be actually exposing it, metabolizing things? We know phenotypically, as Tatiana was describing, it's looking bad. We don't know at the moment how it looks molecularly, how many mutations it's accumulating, and what's happening to these astronauts. So what about the liver? It's, as I said, a remarkable system. We want to understand the metabolism there. We want to see how is it going to process this environmental exposure? How is it going to metabolize drugs? Because again, we know it will be different. We know when it comes to mutation, it's probably going to be much worse, but we don't know how much worse. And again, we don't know whether that's because you get much more DNA damage. Again, you have radiation, you have lack of gravity, or because your repair is not active as much in space. And again, the liver also provides a very nice complementary system to the hematopoietic stem cells, because now you have something that's very well protected and you have another cell type that's very well exposed to everything. So we are in the process of generating this data and trying to understand it, and I hope in the next year or two to have some interesting data. So let me just give you a summary of what I talked about. Mutations, important. Accumulate in every single cell of our body. And essentially, the more you accumulate, the more your cells become deficient in performing their tasks. If you look at the hematopoietic stem cells and you put them in space, you're going to have 3 to 6 times amplification in the number of mutations they accumulate. So something very bad is happening to the genetic material, to the DNA of these cells. We do not know what's happening to the liver. I expect it to be worse. I expect it to be accumulating much more. Again, if you want to do a, 6 or 8 month flight to Mars, and these people need to eat food, presumably, so you're going to be accumulating these mutations at rates that may make it completely unfeasible for them to reach Mars without a cancer. So we do look forward to exploring this, understanding it, as Tatiana said, trying to actually prevent it and treat it, and then telling you more about it. Thank you so much.
All right, wow. Great talks. I'm going to have the speakers come up and have a chair so we can take some questions. And some questions?
Do you have any imaging studies or biopsy on astronauts that have come back at differential durations in space? Or look at the correlation with your...
if I just can start answering. That's a great question. Unfortunately, the astronauts are so protected. So they probably can donate blood, but there is no possibility to take any biopsies.
But the mice, you know, which is set
the
up
mice.
There. Go ahead.
But mice are not people.
I thought they didn't like having mice because they start floating around.
Yeah. And
I know that they, the NASA astronauts, which are sort of, basically military employees for the most part, they're very closely watched. So lately, the experience that they've been talking about is some we've been using the private astronauts who in the Axiom mission. So we've been on all the Axiom missions, which is a sort of a private endeavor to build a new space station. Currently, there's a sort of space race, if you will, for companies to deliver the next generation of orbital research. Like there's several companies thinking different ways that they're going to deliver, things into space. What's that space station? Because we know that the ISS has to be decommissioned coming up pretty soon, and so there needs to be some sort of replacement. I heard one back there, and then we'll go here. Go to the back.
When you talk about all the billions and trillions and all the big numbers of cells and things going on, there was no mention in any of the talks about mitochondria. How is mitochondria, why was that missing, or is it not worth discussing?
So I have to say, we do look at the mitochondria and the number of copies. Yes, I didn't present it tonight, but we very much look at the mitochondria and the number of copies of the mitochondria and how they change. These private astronauts that Sheldon alluded to, we have their blood 45 days before the mission, the day before the mission, in space, coming down. And you can see how mutations are accumulating, but you can also see how the number of mitochondria goes highly up, and then when they come down 45 days, goes down. So you can see that there is a very big mitochondrial dynamic.
But there's also a mitochondrial dysfunction. Lee probably knows a lot about this, but... the same disease that Tatiana and Ludmila were talking about, this MASH, there's not a decrease so much in mitochondria as a mitochondrial dysfunction. When you assess the ability of mitochondria to undergo what they're supposed to do, respiration, it's much depressed. So aging depresses mitochondrial function, and MASH depresses mitochondrial function. And Ludmila's going to figure out whether space travel depresses mitochondrial function.
And as you know, the mitochondria, for those who don't know, is sort of like the little power plant in the cell itself, an organelle. And so a lot of people see that as an important aspect of cellular function. I saw one up here.
How did the space program welcome this news? What were the intersections? What was the dynamic like?
Well,
something was happening, they asked you to do research, or you kind of...
Well, we've been doing the research, and I think that they're very interested. We've been, Dr. Jameson has been presented, went to the White House just, I think, a few weeks ago, actually, to present to all the agencies, and everybody's interested in what we've been doing, and, what's the future of space. Because, it's going to be more and more important both for...
Do they have to do damage control or something?
Well, I think that they're very protective of the astronauts, as Tatiana referred to, and so they don't really talk about them. But we do see that some of those Apollo guys, they lived quite long lives, so it isn't necessarily a death sentence to be an astronaut. We make it sound like that, but it isn't really the case. But there's a lot of implications to long-term space flight. Do we go to Mars? And that's why we've actually spoken to like SpaceX, because I know that's sort of there. But when you talk to SpaceX, they say, well, we'll get to that. We're still trying to figure out how to get there. And so they take one thing at a time. But down the road, you have to think of it. Other questions? Magda?
Yeah.
And then Christina?
Great presentation. And the question I have actually is not related to space, but to the first slide that you put there, David, like healthy liver, healthy life, right?
Yeah. That's my motto.
What's the effect of microplastics?
Oh, that's a great question.
It's not known, but people assume that the place where this is screened is the Kupffer cells in the liver. So the liver should be the most sensitive, you know. And actually, people have asked me, because we are getting livers from donors that are declined for transplant, that we should analyze that. So that you've stimulated my thinking. Because the two things that people have asked me about are microplastics, and also whether normal livers have bacteria, live bacteria in them. Because also for the same reason that from the digestive tract, that's what the portal blood is what clears it. Yeah, so good, thank you.
Christine?
So one is for Ludmil, Dr. Alexandrov, can you tell us, I'm not sure if you are allowed, but in looking at the, well, you know, in the mutational profile of the bone marrow that have the increased mutations, can you tell if it's more from the radiation or from the microgravity?
Yeah, so we know it's not from the radiation. Right. That's one of the, as a matter of fact, we pulled out the radiation locks and the radiation for each one. And these astronauts, at least that we get, or they don't do spacewalks. And they seem to be screened rather well, because there is still elevated radiation, but not as much as I would have expected. So we know that they're not from the radiation. What causes this mutation? My hypothesis is that the DNA repair is just at much lower levels in outer space, and you just accumulate, because we see the normal process that you see on the ground, but at much faster rate.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. and it gives us hope, right? So,
the cells, they need to, again, to produce energy, they need to divide just because they exist. And the repair processes are mitigating the damage. What I think is happening is that this mitigation is much worse in space, that the repair processes are not operating as well as they are on terrestrial ground.
And that is because?
Oh, that's because we don't know. that's because we need to figure out, yeah. No, not at the moment.
So, anyway, Christiane, we still have another question here. Why don't you go first?
Please, go ahead.
The Mediterranean diet is the preferred diet for longevity, but that includes red wine, and alcohol, of course, you're saying, is a damaging factor to the liver. Is there any evidence as to substituting reservoir for red wine as being less damaging?
There was a controlled trial with resveratrol. Resveratrol is the antioxidant in red wine. And there was a controlled trial, and it didn't help. It didn't make any difference. So everyone was so excited that you could do just what you suggested, but it didn't work. So the Mediterranean diet is not the only diet. You know, we compared the Okinawa diet to the Mediterranean diet. And the Okinawa diet has a lot of seaweed. They both have fish. They both have almost no red meat, you know, no beef. And they both have small amounts of alcohol. And when people tried to look for something common, you know, the Mediterranean diet has olive oil, and the Okinawa diet does not. But there is a compound called polyphenols that's common to both diets. So people think that might be the common mediator. In olive oil, it would be the polyphenols, but in seaweed, it would be the polyphenols. So that's the closest people have come to trying to understand a common mediator. But red wine it's not the answer. Sorry to disappoint you.
There's the Seventh-day Adventist in that blue group.
Yes.
They don't drink alcohol.
At all. So the Seventh-day Adventists, they do not drink alcohol. They do not have coffee. They're strictly vegetarian. So I used to moonlight in the Seventh-day Adventist hospital, and they would have the pseudo meat. It was just awful. So I am not convinced Seventh-day Adventists live longer. I think they're just so miserable. They think they're living longer.
No, right. Did you have another question, Christina, and then we can go back.
Yeah. Sorry. Thank you for taking my second question. So the other aspect of the liver that is really, I'm a scientist, and I was immediately fascinated by the liver when I was 3 years old because my father was in an accident, and he had to have more than half of his liver resected, and it regenerated and grew back. So do you think, have you seen that role of the regenerative capacity of liver maybe playing a role in space and maybe can mitigate some of the, you know, higher levels of damage that might happen.
Tatiana's a little researcher. She knows all this. So.
The answer is that we don't know what happens with the liver and regeneration. Again, so after 6 months in space, people actually, you know, the astronauts come back and they recover from the injury. But we don't know what is the regeneration capacity unless we take the cells. And one of the problems why we really cannot study liver using other cell sources, the system is not developed. We need to study the patient cells. So we cannot generate liver cells from from blood cells or from iPS cells. So they don't mimic the function. So it's the future studies.
So I'll take one or two more questions. We'd wrap up. Greg, I think you had one up front here.
Yeah, I mean, this is on the Earth, but with the metabolic syndrome that it's really the American syndrome, and it's pretty ubiquitous, and you get it with a lot of medications, particularly antipsychotics and things that, you know, really create metabolic syndrome. And the GLP-1s look like they're the first thing in many decades that have a lot of punch to them. So you would probably know better than anybody. Are we looking at some native aspects of that? I mean, it's all over the internet now.
David can comment on this.
We're Zambic and we go, yeah. Duck in a box.
So the original GLP-1 agonists, like Ozempic, they, what we call defat the liver. They stop the metabolism, but they don't seem to reverse the damage so much. The second generation of drugs include a second agonist. So it's GLP-1 plus GIP, which is another hormone, or GLP-1 plus a glucagon agonist. And in those cases, they look better. So the first generation are not going to be the answer, but the second generation might very well be. And what you're left with is some chronic scarring that seems to be not responsive to these agonists. And so that's sort of what our lab has been working on, to try to understand if there's a separate way of approaching the fibrosis in addition to approaching metabolism. Yeah, so that's where we are. But that's a good pickup on your part.
And with that, I think we're going to conclude. Thanks for our great speakers. That was a good help.
That was so much fun.